kids who came from, you know, sheep herding families out at Navajo and fishing families at Warm Springs and Cherokee speaking families from Oklahoma. They were the ones who got 4 point, went right through and went to law school and went back home to work. And I thought, we really made a success here. That's success, when we can teach people so that they have something to be used in their communities. And native language and native culture gave them the strength to do that. So every time you're tempted to think that what kids need to do is to give up in order to go forward, think twice about it. Some things, yes, that may be true. They may need to give up some things, and I can talk about those too. They may need to alter some things. They may need to alter some perceptions. One of the perceptions they might need to alter is that everything the non-Indian world has to offer is worthless. and that's not true either. They often do have that perception. But one of the things they don't need to alter is that grasp of what is at home, because that will give them the kind of cultural strength to carry on. Look at yourself and ask yourself about your own life and what you need in this life. And you wouldn't be here in a folk cultural seminar if you didn't think that was important. So the very first admission of that, I think, is really a recognition that we have got to support and preserve those things which are essential to survival.
I was going to ask you about the Baptists back in Oklahoma.
Cherokee Baptist, right.
You say that they're beginning now to go to the stomp dances. Mm-hmm. Are they mm-hmm. beginning to see the value in getting back to somehow their Indian
traditions? Well, some are not. Some are not. And there's a very strong... There is a very strong prohibition against it, and a very strong almost injunction against it by many of the people who have been Christian since the 18th century. And they've been Christian a long time, as long as anybody else in America, you know, put it that way. And there is a very strong injunction against that, and many ministers do preach against it and so forth.
They see that as robbing them of their Christianity.
That's right. That's right. Pagan. It's purely pagan. And that's fine. They're entitled to that opinion. I think that's a perspective. I guess what I'm suggesting is that on the other end, the stomp dance people don't perceive that that's a problem, because what they say is that we can absorb everything. We're big enough and rich enough to take in everything that's possible, as long as people's hearts are with other people. And that's what they say. That I have an uncle named Willie Sam, who's one of the stomp dance leaders. We're organized around very much like we're a southeastern tribe, and we're organized the same way that many of the Creek towns and people were organized. That is, seven towns around a center, and our old stomp grounds. We have seven of them around the periphery of our political life, which is also layered in there. And my uncle is very philosophical about it. He believes that people really can absorb enormous difference and enormous diversity and live with contradictions. And that's okay too. He doesn't think that that's a bad thing, as long as people understand, you know, what they're doing within those contradictions. And it is the contradictions that are hard for people. It is the contradictions that are extremely hard for people. And that places an enormous burden on them if those contradictions are not resolved. But I think he fully believes that they can resolve them, and that in the community of the stomp, that is inherently resolved because they are accepting of that kind of diversity. The important thing in those events is to be of one heart, as he says. And that's the important thing, to be of one heart. And if you're not of one heart, then healing will not take place, renewal will not take place, and all the important things that people are go to stomp for. That's why they belong. That's why they go to that ground, so that they'll be renewed and healed. It's really not very different from any other religion that I know of in that sense. And his feeling is that we can absorb all of those things. But I think the perspective is really one of respect. And I think that word is key. And I'm going to use that word over and over again, because that's what it really has to do with. It has to do with respect. Even when you don't agree with another perspective. I'll tell you another old story. I'll be full of those. Red Jacket, the old Seneca, so-called Red Chief, the war chief, not a white chief or a peace chief. When in the 18th century, when the Seneca really, all the Iroquois Confederacy was in a real dilemma about whether to join these new Americans and go for the revolution with the Americans, or to stay on the side of the British, or to join the French. They were really in quite a dilemma. And they really did have some serious political choices, and many of them certainly stuck with the British, who had in fact been their allies traditionally for a long time. And they were eventually run off into Canada. And the Seneca tried to stay neutral and simply couldn't do it, and ended up siding on the British. And George Washington's troops then burned all of the Seneca towns in New York and Ohio. And they were driven back to two or three very much reduced reservation areas from the Treaty of 1794, the Big Tree Treaty. And Red Jacket said, you know, he said once our lands were endless, and we ask you here, and we gave you land, and now we have scarce a place to spread a blanket. He said, but that's not the only thing. You want to force your religion upon us. You know, why can't you have room? And I think that's one of the most serious things that we really have to contend with in this history. And history as we understand it really has been a process of trying to force people to choose. And choice is not the issue, but rather an absorption of everything. So I think that's what we really need to do is be supportive of Native people's need to survive, which really means embracing a whole range of things, including new religions. They're very flexible. You know, Indians, my gosh, I can't think of anybody that's more adaptable than Indian people. The fact that we are alive today is just an extraordinary testimony to our resilience. And boy, have we got something to teach you, you know, for surviving into the 21st and 22nd century. We have a secret, and that's part of what I want to talk to you about. Somebody had, yeah.
Yes, on stop dancing, I have the image.
I would say that stomp is only religious. In fact, one of the things about stomp dancing that's really extraordinary is that we don't do it for social occasions. Oh, it's fun. But
after hours, couples carrying
out. Yeah. Well, let me talk about it from a different perspective. After hours is an interesting way of phrasing it. To me, it takes place during the time. It takes place from midnight on or 11, very late at night, till dawn. The reason it takes place then is because that is the time when the most, how to phrase this correctly, I haven't really thought about it in that way. Let me go backwards. In European culture, you know what's out there in the dead of night. I mean, booga booga, right? You know, all kinds of things loose out there, spirits, witches. You know, let's use European culture and go back. It's the time before the dawn when the most danger is in the world from a European basis. And actually, every culture in the world really operates on this basis. The night is a heavy-duty time. Because in the dark, lots of things are loose from a traditional perspective, from a European one, which is booger bears. My grandmother used to tell me that, you know, the booger bears were out there at night, and that's why I wasn't supposed to get out of my bed. You all know that. You knew that. When your mom puts you to bed, you don't leave because they're out there. And while I have yet to see one, I know what's out there. The night is a very powerful time. The night is the time when you might have access, because the spirits are abroad, you might have access to enormous power and enormous danger. So it's very important to dance at night. It's very important to dance before the dawn and to greet the sun coming up. So instead of being an after-hours dance, what I would suggest is that this is a necessary time to participate, because this is the time of the most possibility for healing in the enormous night when all of the spirits are out. this is the time when the most power can be accessed. It's just like just putting your plug into that old, you know, in that old outlet, which is more than 220 volts, I'll guarantee you. And so it's a religious time. It's a sacred time, and has been for centuries. And the stomp really is never done secularly. I don't know of anybody who will come and perform it for a public audience. Now, in some places in the Southeast, they don't mind doing that. A couple people will, and that's okay too. People accept that. But at home in Oklahoma, we don't. We literally don't. You cannot film it. You cannot record it. In fact, when Uncle Willie and some of the singers did a recording for Charlotte Heth, who is a Cherokee ethnomusicologist, they wouldn't do it at the stomp grounds because the stomp grounds is sacred. That's where the seven fires burn. And we brought those fires from as far as New Echota in North Georgia, which is our spiritual homeland, where all peace prevailed, where no war could be undertaken at the place where our homeland was, which is now, by the way, partly covered by Tennessee Tombigbee Dam. And if you wonder why the Cherokee people fought that dam so, see, this is how politics gets into it, because there's a cultural base to it. That was our spiritual homeland. We didn't want that to be covered up because that's the place where we brought the fires from, and we've had those fires since time immemorial. So contrary to being a social event, oh, of course it's a social event. Everything is. Church Sunday morning is a social event. Everybody sees everybody and visits and shares. And yes, it's a social event, and yes, it's fun. And that's one of the things that I want you to understand about Indian religions. We don't prohibit fun. We think it's wonderful to have a good time because that is an expression of gratitude to the maker of breath for leaving us all here and letting us be fed and be grateful. So people laugh. People have a good time in those dances. A couples dancing, there isn't much of. There's some in some of the stomps you do have couples dancing, but you know, in most Indian dances, it's almost like being in a junior high when I was a kid. Girls dance together and men dance together. I mean, you know, you just don't mix. But the stomp is really not a social event. It's a religious event. And really very sacred. But to be very sacred doesn't mean that you're very serious. It means that you have a good time. So that's another thing I really want to convey to you is that it's a very different thing. Has anybody ever been up to the Southwest and been to the Pueblo dances? Where you say, I want to come back to the Holy Clowns in a minute. Several people have questions. Yeah.
I want to go back to what you were talking about, the restoration or the preservation of language. I'm very disturbed about what I call a perversion of the English language by a lot of the new words that we have today that I consider, I guess I'm a snob, I consider substandard. Would you say there was a parallel between wanting to preserve the language as it was, as you are talking about the preservation of the old language?
Well, now there are two differences. I think language preservation is a marvelous thing, but language preservation is not the same thing as language guardianship. And I want to tell you, I love change, and Indian people love change. Change is a wonderful thing. Change is dynamic. Change makes things grow. You survive by change. And the English language, I don't think, is in any danger whatsoever of loss as a language. We're not in any danger whatsoever of losing English. What we are in danger of, if it's danger at all, and I don't particularly think so, is the notorious corruption of the English language. I don't worry about that. I don't worry about that because it shows that change shows that a language is capable of growing and evolving and moving. And I love that. And I think we shouldn't be too careful to squeeze things to death. And that's one of the things that we do with Indian people all the time. We just squeeze them to death, you know. We want them to live only in the 19th century. We want them to stay fixed to precious in time. Spray them and mount them and put them in a case, you know. No. No, no, no. Don't do that. And don't do that to your own culture. Revere the past. But let it grow and let it move and let it change. What I think we do need to do is preserve our guardianship over the things that really do matter. Not the introduction of new words, but in fact, the elegance of language. I love language. I love how elegant it can be. And to speak it and write it well is a glorious gift.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. Yeah. Because so much of what we're hearing today is, I just can't put a word on it. But I think you know what I mean.
Oh, I do. And I think, but I think there really is a difference. I think there really is a difference between one of the things that I always tell people is, you know, it's really quite shocking because we grow up thinking that Indians or black folks or Hispanic folks speak substandard English. They don't speak substandard English. They speak a different variant of English. And I think we ought to be really appreciative of those variants in the same way that I'm deeply appreciative of regional styles of English. I am not going to give up my Oklahoma accent for anything. And believe me, they tried to stomp it out of me. I have been to the best schools in the country and they tried to make me speak like a Harvard girl, and I'm not going to do it. I'm absolutely not going to do it. If I have to wear cowboy boots to my death, I will go wearing cowboy boots to my death. And preserving my regional language. And there are some variants of my regional language that are wonderful. I would not give up the turn of phrase and the elegance of speech that's culturally varied, valued in Texas and Oklahoma, but is not valued at all in Boston. And that's okay. You know. And likewise, I think Bostonians ought to fight hard for the preservation of that. And I think people in Tennessee and Georgia ought to care deeply about the preservation of regional variants. But what I like is that I can speak several languages. I've always valued my ability to speak several languages, and I think you ought to too. And if I can grow up speaking those several linguistic variants, then I'm a truly educated person. I am not truly educated if I can only speak one. What wouldn't you give to be able to speak to the whole world? To be able to go home? I don't want to be able to pick up the phone and talk to my mama and abuse her sense of how I ought to talk by having become a different person. I want to be able to talk to her in the language that I grew up talking to her in. And I think it would be an abuse if I didn't do that. I want to be able to go home to Oklahoma and talk to people in Tahlequah and talk to people out in Stillwell and Hulbert and Peavine, you know? And I want other people to have that variant. So we've got to give students, we've got to give ourselves the latitude to speak the multitude of languages and speak them all well. And in terms of speaking English, we have such a repertoire of possibilities in English. You know, we have academic English, and we have, you know, the Queen's English, don't you wish you could do that, but let's leave it to the British, who I hope are preserving it. We have regional variants. We have black English. We even have Indian English. Some of you probably don't even know what it is. In Oklahoma, we call it talking Indian. And it's an English variety, which is very distinctly Indian, and which comes out of probably the experience of Indian schools. It was probably devolved through the experience of Indian schools. Well, all of those are rich and interesting. And I think it would be extraordinary if we all supported the preservation of all the languages we speak. I wonder if most of you know how many languages you speak. You speak one language to the phone company, and you speak one language to mama, and you speak another language among your friends, and so forth. But that preservation of an ability to do it all is what I want for our children and for a legacy. Because I think the preservation of all that richness is really a gift. It's really a gift. Who would choose to only speak one? And the problem is that we are consigning children to speaking only one because it's too confusing for us. See, we don't have to do all that as educators. We don't have to teach them all the languages. We only have to support their growth and preservation. We may only have to teach one or two. There used to be a course in high schools called Business English, and I could never figure out what that is until I grew up. Now I know, I sort of don't want to speak it. I guess I want to write it, but it's an inelegant and very rudimentary form. But it's important to know how to write it. You have to know how to write those letters to the phone company, you know. But I don't want to talk to my mama that way. But we do have to preserve those. But you don't have to teach more than one or two. Let the homes do that, but support them in doing it. I think that's part of what I wanted to say about supporting native languages anywhere. You don't have to do that. Maybe sometime you will have to. Maybe you'll have to support the development of a Seminole language class or a Creek language class in your school, and I hope you do. I hope you do. But it's just one more language to be added to that cultural support. Because that diversity is just so emotionally important, you know, for us all to look at ourselves and say, hey, I'm terrific. My language is great. I come from a home that's wonderful and to be valued. And that, I think, is what is it critical to be able, for those kids to be able to look in a mirror and say, look, you know, I'm okay. I'm okay. I'm not, as I was told when I first went to the university, you know, semi-literate. And I was told that by professors who really wanted to squeeze out of me that Oklahoma accent. And just like sitting on the table, I rebelled. I refused. Yeah.
I kind of get the impression that a lot of their religious views is, whereas I think Christianity is very linear. It's good, yeah. Bad, you know, very linear.
Choices are very defined. Yeah.
Right. Black, white. Where I get the feeling that the Native religious perspective is more spherical, and I don't really want to relate it to Eastern religions, but possibly...
There are more relationships, though.
It's yeah.
Well, yes and no. I will tell. We have our Ayatollahs, too, you know. I don't want to... That's another thing. And you've brought up something...
Far Eastern.
Yeah, that's right. You have brought up something that I just really want to work with you on, too. One of the things that I find in America is that there's a real divergent treatment of Indians, and some people just can't stand them, and other people just love them to death. And being loved to death is as much of a problem as being hated. You just, you know, and there are lots of ways people love Indians to death. One of them, and we see a lot of this, I don't want to blame California for a lot of ills, but I'll beat up on California since I'm in Florida. One of the things we see is a whole lot of people joining movements that want to look to Indian religious belief, Indian sacredness, as a vehicle for their salvation. And let me just say a couple things about that and then come back to the very interesting, I think, important point you made about linearity versus circularity, if you will. And that's just patterns of thought. I think that has to do with patterns of thought. But there's a whole lot of what I call guruismo about Indians. You know, people will come up and say, oh, you just have so much to teach us. Well, yeah, but not what you think, you know. And the fact is that the other thing is that I don't think people should ask Indians to give them one more thing. Not willingly. They've already just given just a whole lot. And there's a whole lot more to be learned. But... not through Indians giving it up, but rather through all of the rest of the world sort of learning in a hard way. It's hard to learn this stuff. You can't just sort of plug into this spiritual outlet and say, oh, I just have people in California just say, oh, I just believe we've just been so wrong in the Western world, and Indians just have so much to give us, and so forth. And they come and they will tell me that they've been attending sweat lodges given by what some German friends of mine call plastic medicine men. And believe me, there are scams out there to be had, too. You cannot plug into this stuff and be resistant to all this fake religious stuff that is just another religious scam. Believe me, it's no different than any other one. People will take your money happily and go off and give you a little chicken feather and a little vial of water and make you believe that you have just been to the source of, you know, the great chief walking eagle or whatever name they purport to be. And I will guarantee you there's a whole lot of fakery around, and that's one of the things we have to be resistant to. We have to learn when something is running a number on us, running a scam on us, and Indian religions are one of them. And it's the kind of thing, because people are so vulnerable, when they think they love Indians, what they really want is part of this sort of veneer of spirituality that Indians have in this country, but that people really don't know about, and people really don't know what real Indian religions have and have to offer. One of the first things I'd say is that Indians have, on the whole, and I'll make a generic statement here, no intent or notion at all to missionary to anybody. They do not particularly care. Most Indian religious people don't care whether you join their religion or not. In fact, they mostly don't want to. Unless you were born in it, unless you grew up in it. They don't want to keep you out, but on the other hand, they really don't missionary. They're not interested in that sort of thing. So if you find somebody really trying to convince you that this is wonderful and you can come put your little plug in that outlet right away, you know you might be dealing with somebody who's a little off. And run. It will cost you money and you won't get much for it. But beyond that, Indian religions and Indian perspectives, I think, do have a great deal to teach if we can understand them from an intellectual perspective and at the same time understand them from an emotional perspective. Because one of the things they do have to teach I hate to even use these kinds of words, a holistic form of thinking. But you understand what I mean. That is, they don't separate things out from other things. Things are not linear. I don't get from, in most Indian cultures, I don't get from point A to point B by a straight line. I might get from point A to point B by a lot of divergent paths, most of which wander around and will eventually get to that point. I like to symbolize it this way. You know, this is reducing cultures to stereotypes too, but it maybe I make the point. In Western culture, you have square houses, the box step, square meal. And in Indian cultures, you have the round dance, things are done in circles. And this is true of Buddhism and some of the other Eastern religions, too. It's a very different way of conceptualizing the world. A very different way of conceptualizing the world. And that doesn't mean that one or the other is bad or good. It just means that you get from different points to different points. Western science, inductive reasoning, and science by inductive reasoning is a product of a square world. And we would not have that if we did not have that product of a square world. And it is a miracle to have inductive reasoning and that kind of science. But Indian science is another kind. And so, there are miracles to be had there as well in a perception of the world. I want to do some things with that. Part of what we've been doing, in fact, is an example of nonlinear relationships. We've been talking about a wide range of things. I started out really by talking about the sacredness of all things. And what we've really come down to is a whole range of things. And that is an example, I like to think, of a different style of teaching. And for me, that's critical if we're going to teach about Indian things in our schools, if we're going to teach about Indian culture, to try and begin to understand those relationships of all things so that we don't do, in part, I know we literally have to do this in the classroom, but I want to think about some possibilities for restructuring an approach to teaching that really doesn't lock us in the now we will look at Seminole basket work. Now we will look at patchwork. Now we will look at music and dance. Because if we were really to teach about them in an organic context, we wouldn't do it that way at all. Things would come up as they come up. And one thing would inevitably lead to another. And all things would come back around and again and again and again. The other thing that I would say that's important as a perspective, and I'm talking really about method, I'm really talking about teaching method here, is that things don't have to take only this 20 minutes. Maybe they need to come back 6 months from now. Maybe they need to come back 8 months from now. Maybe they need to come back next week. But come back always, because it's simply a process. All we do is begin a process, and then we let it come back and come back and enrich itself, because in order to really understand things, we can't just take this little segment out and let it happen. We can't just take it and say that it begins and ends there. It has to be a growth process. We can't do, for example, I think, a unit on basket work and have it in there. Let me give you an example why. And I think this is really, really critical and important. Let's just look at... I suppose basket work's as good as any. I mean, we could take any one of examples. And I want to really talk about how we might take a political, a cultural, a historical perspective on something as simple as a basket. And let's look at, say, a palmetto basket, and we might then look at another kind of basket, say a pine needle basket. made all the pine needle baskets made by people throughout the Southeast, the palmetto baskets being much more located toward Florida and coastal regions. Let's just take those two kinds of basketry and ask ourselves what we might do with that if we were really going to operate from a cultural perspective and try to introduce children and ourselves, in essence, to a different way of looking at things, All right. A palmetto basket. What can we do with that? What can you do in a classroom with a palmetto basket? What in the world can you teach? What kind of classroom would it be appropriate for? All ages, yeah. There really are no age boundaries. That's one of the things that's really important about all this stuff, by the way. There are, I would think, no age boundaries for any of these things, but that we'd have to reorient them differently depending on what we're going to do. What kinds of classes, what would you want to teach from talking about basket work?
Observation.
That's a marvelous thing to teach. I have a whole exercise, by the way, that if anybody would like on... On exam